Close to 200,000 in a population of less than a million. Okay, so poetry and economics. Interesting combination. First I want to get a sense, though, of how many of you read poetry regularly? Or a little bit. Oh, yeah, sweet. Yeah, that's a start. Okay, you read poetry. Okay, good. Okay, we have a couple people. This is not uncommon. And in fact, I think we can understand what, to a certain extent, the relative level of culture in a population by the number of people that we can see reading poetry. I just read a few weeks ago, and I wrote a poem, actually, I was working on for a while, about this culture in Spain, in the Middle Ages, called Andalusia, Kingdom of Andalusia. It was a caliphate. This was an Arab or a Moorish kingdom. Now, at that time, okay, this is the height of the Dark Ages in Europe, and you had farmers, as they were plowing their fields, composing poetry. You had people could go to a king or a governor, and through poetry, they could get people released from prison. They could have death sentences lifted from people. You could change the opinion of a diplomat through poetry. It was considered one of the main institutions in this kingdom. They also had free public education, which is interesting, as well as a private institution, or private institutions. They had universities, which developed first out of their mosques. This is like from about 700 to 1200 AD. When most people, Charlemagne, he couldn't read or write. And you had peasants composing poetry in southern Spain. It's possible that maybe since Greece and up to the present day, no culture has attained this level of development of the population. A case could maybe be made. Something that's interesting about Andalusia, just as we're kind of getting into this, is that this kingdom was one of the main bridges from the classical world of Greece and Rome, particularly Greece, to the Renaissance period. Dante was inspired by the Andalusian poets who were developing certain forms of poetry which he picked up on and used in his Divine Comedy and some of his other works. And many of the Greek texts there's this one king, there's a story, who was sending various dignitaries out all over the Mediterranean, Europe, into the East, to collect all the texts that they could find. All the ancient texts, all the literature. And they would bring them back to Toledo, which was the center of translations at the time. They would have them translated into Arabic. And this is how these texts were preserved. It wasn't because of the Europeans that we know about Greek civilization or that we have those texts today. It's actually Arab poetry. So poetry has a very important role in culture. Now, talk about economics, though. It's a little bit different. It seems a little bit different. But there's a couple ways that we can go at this. And first I'd like to bring up this question, which I know we've brought up in presentations before, is this question of what are resources? Does anybody have an idea what we think natural resources? Anybody? members can make suggestions too. There's going to be this tonight. We're going to be looking at a poem. It's mostly going to be like a discussion. It's not really going to be any kind of a formal lecture. So I'll be looking for a lot of help from you guys, but a resource, something like. Okay, what is a resource? Economic resource.
Well, it is something that, you use.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you want or you need for your society.
Yeah,
you discover a tool or a machinery, how you could produce one thing out of nature to use it.
Yeah.
Like, for your needs.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're talking about, it could be long for those, it could be minerals, oil, trees, lumber and stuff, water. Pretty well anything that we use. Any plants, clothing. So it comes from, there's some kind of process that we go through to develop these materials. So how do we actually develop resources? What is the process that human society has to go through to try to discover new ones, or even use a resource like oil?
Hmm?
Yeah, creativity. We have to actually make some kind of. Hmm? Yeah, we have to make a scientific discovery, maybe. You know, we have to develop a process. We have to create a process to actually use these materials.
Okay. Otherwise, it would be using oil as
maybe
a cream.
If
there's no transformation.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So we take something that could be a rock on the ground, which really doesn't have a whole lot of value, and through the intervention of the human mind, we can create all kinds of stuff. Maybe there's uranium in that rock. Maybe there's iron. Some other minerals that we can use. Actually, we can increase the value and the effect of that. What was just a rock becomes something that, who knows? Maybe that rock is turned into some kind of metal that sent somebody to the moon. Okay, so this question of creativity though, and I think LaRouche has argued this before, and I think I'd like to make the statement at this time that creativity is the greatest resource that humans have. And it's not a limited resource. Because creativity is that element that must be a part of any process of development. So human creativity is acting at all times in economics and science and culture. Okay, there isn't any point when we're, yeah?
Would all this be grounding?
Well, we could talk about that. Who? Okay. This is one of the problems today, though. We live in a post-industrial society.
Why are you thinking?
Post-industrial?
Yeah.
It's the idea that this is part of the cultural paradigm shift that we talked about that happened in the 60s, where the environmental movement started, and there's a process, and this is what globalization, isn't it? Is a process of shutting down industrial production in the West and shipping those back or that production off to the third world. And so what then we develop at home is a service-based economy. Right? Most of us, if we have jobs, we're not actually producing something. What we're going to do is we're going to be selling products, we're going to be making food, serving food, something like that, working in an office, maybe sitting in front of a computer screen. This is basically what people do in our economies. Now, part of this question of economics is that in a real functioning economy, in a real functioning society, you have a majority, or at least 50%, at least half of your population engaged in some kind of productive employment. It could be science and technology, it could be working in factories. I mean, there are a lot of different ways of thinking about production. Okay? But you should have at least half of your population engaged in this kind of a process. But today, it's something like 20% or less than 20%. The population is engaged in anything that actually produces real physical wealth. It's about 20%. If you look at Statistics Canada, you look at the breakdown of labor in Canada, and that's only of the labor force, let's remember that. So what you're actually talking about is maybe 5% of the population as a whole. You count children, you count elderly people, so retired people, people that aren't working and so on. That's purely those who are in the labor force. Okay, now with production, you need to produce something. You create something. And this is we have a chart actually. I don't know if we have it. Can we get this the folded one? Because there's actually a link between having a society that produces things and in a society that thinks creatively. Okay? So the thing is at the same time as you have an economy that's growing, is producing real wealth, is developing higher and higher levels of productivity and technology infrastructure, you have the development of the minds of that population. As a necessary condition to use these higher levels of technology and infrastructure, okay? And you think about an operative, like Merv was talking about these machine tool operatives a little bit tonight. He was talking about these machine tool operatives. Yeah? Who are operating this advanced technology of people that are working in science, and everything like that. They have to be very creative. Even I worked a couple summers in a factory. I was just in the packaging department, but one thing you would do, because it could be really boring. I mean, you're working on a line, right? You're doing the same task that you are repetitively. But what you can do to make it interesting and something that generally, like a well-run factory is engaging in is a process where the employees themselves are the ones that are developing many of the ideas about how to do things better. How to create a product more efficiently, how to create better tools, a whole bunch of stuff like this. So there's a process of development going on. The people themselves, the workers are actively participating in the creation of this product. They're having to be creative in their jobs. Okay. Now this is something that this concept of creativity as being a force in the economy does not exist really in a post-industrial society. You look at what do people do in their spare time? Yeah. What is it? Their spare time when they're not working at whatever service type of job, yeah. Yeah, they watch TV, okay. What else do they do?
Yeah,
in front of the computer? Yeah.
No.
Smoke marijuana? Yeah. That guy used to do. Hip hop? Yeah. Yeah, play video games. Now, is any of this stuff creative in nature?
No,
not really. Really nothing that people do, even reading most novels. Most novels that you read.
Harry Potter,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Most of this stuff is not doing anything to your mind. It's not improving your mind. I read Dante's Divine Comedy a little while ago, which is a big, beefy work, but it's very, very, it's worth it. Everybody should read this, okay? And what I noticed as I was reading it is that Dante was changing me as I read these books. I was actually a different person at the end of the Paradiso than I was at the when I opened up the Inferno. This is for real. That work will change you as a person. You know, if you read it this way. And that's the mark of good literature. Or great literature. Universal literature. That it changes the person. Now most people today don't want to put in the effort to read through something like that. Because, they're more interested in some kind of, instance, gratification. Just give it to me now. Like I have this story, I tell everybody this because it's so funny. I write poetry, okay? This is, and a few weeks ago, I got, we don't need this up here. I received a phone call from my, a relative of mine. I won't mention his name. And typical of many in the baby boomer generation, although there are good baby boomers. She says, why do you have to make your poetry so intellectual? Why can't you just, give me the meaning on the surface? So, you know, I can read it and I can know right away what you're saying. Why can't you do that? Or write something about, you know, your emotions. She's my landlord, so I'm living in her apartment. But it's so I'm just shaking my head though, because I'm thinking how can somebody be saying, why don't you be less intellectual? Why are you talking about complex ideas? Or why are you trying to convey an idea that I'm going to have to work hard to understand? I don't want to have to work hard. More feelings, less thinking. And this is a big problem. Okay. So, there's a problem with understanding poetry today. There's a problem with the poet themselves. I was talking to Nick earlier, and are there any modern English poets that you would suggest me to read? And I said, no, there's not. You have to go back about 200 years. Maybe Robert Frost, but that's about it. Okay. And tonight we're going to look at a poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley. I don't know if anybody can help me out with that name. I think he does. Percy B. Shelley. Does everybody have a copy of this poem, by the way?
I don't.
No? Yeah. We're not going to look at it quite yet because we have to kind of figure out what a poem is.
Percy?
Percy, yeah. Okay. So, talk a little bit about the subject of creativity. Well, we're going to develop an idea of what creativity is and what poetry is over the course of tonight. Okay. Does anybody have any ideas about what poetry is all about? You're an existentialist. Maybe.
Ideas.
Yeah. It's very true. Okay, well, I think this question of an idea. Oh, yeah?
It's about combining words which are limited concepts. And creating paradoxes to shift to a higher principle, shift to a higher form of idea, something that you cannot directly.
Does everybody get what he just said?
Yeah. Well, you can say all this in a more simple way.
What did you say?
Why would that be more creative?
There's some people blocking it. Okay. Well, we're going to bring in this question of science and this question of hypothesis to understand why poetry is actually necessary. Okay, as a means of expression. And even, it's even possible that without poets, language itself might not exist, as we know. I think Shelley would back me up on that. Okay. So I think Nick said something very interesting. It's this question of describing or attempting to describe something that is indescribable. Okay. It's not literal. Any poem that you read, you will not get the meaning from the words of the text. Like this poem tonight. You're not going to find the meaning in those words. Yeah, so where's the meaning? You're kind of going to kick you guys out soon. Bunch of existentialist bastards. Okay. Okay, so let's take this question of science, okay? Because this is very important for economics too. How does a scientist go about discovering a new principle? Does everybody know if we talk about a universal physical principle, what we're talking about? What I'm talking about? Is everybody clear on this? Because if you have questions now on this, this is important. Because you want to understand what we're talking about later. Okay. Let's put it this way. The easiest way to think of it is that let's look at gravity. Okay, gravity. A lot of the times in science classes they talk about the force of gravity. Well, what is gravity itself? Is it? It's not like a little green man or something like that. It's not a relationship, or it doesn't exist like in this book. If I drop that book. Gravity doesn't exist in the book. Okay. So, when we talk about a universal physical principle, we're talking about something, a power. Plato talks about the expression of powers as something in the universe, like a law. You can think of it like a law that actually allows certain actions to happen. Okay. So gravity is like a law, power, that allows that book to drop, okay, under various conditions. It's the quality of the universe. Okay? So this is what we mean. And when I say that the universe is governed by these kinds of powers or principles, I mean that all the action, all the perceptions, that we perceive are governed, okay, by the various motions of the universe, the various relationships, the things that we see happen, the phenomena are all governed by powers and principles. Some of these we've discovered, but definitely not all of them. Probably only a fraction. Okay. Now, there's a relationship between poetry and science. In the sense that poetry also is governed by certain principles. Okay? And I'll get back to this in a second. So we've got science. Now, we in the movement believe that there's a certain intention behind the universe. That it's not just random. It's not governed by chance. Okay? That these principles order everything that we see and everything that we experience. Now, what is ordering the principles? You could say the creator?
Right.
Jesus. but let's think of it in terms of an intention, okay? Or a higher principle. Now, somebody, are you familiar with Johannes Kepler? But he was the fellow that discovered that the orbits are elliptical. Okay. We're not going to go into too much detail about this, but what I just want to put a face. You guys can look into this more on your own, because it's very, very interesting, the process that he goes through. That would take classes upon classes in itself, okay, to really get a mastery. But But it's the idea that Kepler is looking at the universe. He's looking at the orbits of the planets, the visible planets in the sky. And he sees some of them doing weird things, like loops. He actually sees Mars going across the sky, and he sees it loop every 2 years. What the hell? You know, other astronomers have tried to explain that in terms of various models, various statistical models that you see today in economics and things like this, where they say, okay, well, Mars in its orbit at a certain point does a little circle out in space. Just bizarre stuff, you know. But they could fit their statistical model to the observations. But Kepler has a different way of thinking. He says, okay, well, this seems awfully complex and stupid, since I believe that there is a certain harmony in the universe, a certain ordering, that it makes sense, and it should be able to make sense to the human mind. So he says, okay, well, these paradoxes that I see, this looping action, maybe this is telling me that there's something about the universe that we don't know yet. And so he sets out to discover what this principle is. Okay. So he's gone from the actual, you could say, the script, okay, or these phenomena, which I'll compare to the words of this poem, and he's looking for the paradoxes in these phenomena, and he used the paradoxes to discover the idea, okay, to discover this principle of elliptical orbits. Okay. Now, he discovers this principle. What he then has to do is readjust his thinking about everything. Because now that he's made this discovery, this changes everything that he had previously thought about the nature of the solar system. Okay. Now, Plato and Aristotle also had opinions about this question of how we make discoveries. And I've read a little bit of Aristotle. I don't recommend it. It's not worth the time. It's impotent. His philosophy is impotent. So there's no point. Okay. So what would he say? He says that there are two ways that you can know things. You can go from the particulars, your observations of the physical universe, and from those particulars, you develop a general principle or a general rule, okay, that explains the phenomena that you see. Okay, fair enough. Then he says there's another way you can go about it. You can decide on a general principle or general rule and then interpret the phenomena, okay, from that rule. Okay, so that's how Aristotle said you would come to know things. Don't expect him to explain how you come to know that particular general principle that you started from, or how you can even trust the particular phenomena that you began with to get to the general principle. Don't expect that from him, because he's not going to know that. Okay, so it's like, it's like the guys who are looking at the planets, and they see Mars doing this little loop. Okay? And they say, okay, well, the general principle, or the general rule is that these planets all have a little extra loop in their orbits at those, at a certain point, and that's what we see. He doesn't make a hypothesis. It's just description and statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm. So what we are saying is that, these conclusions are based on observations and not experiments.
He might see the thing is he's not that what they're simply trying to do is they get their observations, okay, and then they try to they use statistics. Like today, the best idea is to think of what science is today, where they use statistics or prediction, probability. And this is what they call science. Okay, so you can predict maybe what's going to happen or what percentage of people will die from what disease or something, but people aren't dying from the disease because of the probabilities. Okay, they're not looking for causes. Right? They're just looking to predict what's going to happen next. And this is why nobody could actually determine, okay, or really know what was happening with the orbits. Because the planets are changing all the time, they could never predict where the planet would be at the next moment. This is one of the things that really shows Kepler that something was wrong with the way people were thinking. Okay? This is something, but again, you guys have to look into this.
Not only that, it's that actually you had three complete different models. Okay, three complete different models, and three of them would be able to explain the movement of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So which one is true? Right? Yeah. And the middle? Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's not the other one.
So this is basically an Aristotelian way of thinking about the universe. You have these two different, but what I noticed in these two methods is that there's no change, there's no development of the way that we're thinking about the universe. Okay? There's a certain rigidity to the way to the process itself. It's a formal system. It doesn't change. Okay. Now let's compare this to what Plato was saying. Socrates mentions this in, I think it's book 6 of the Republic. He says, okay, how do we come to know things? He says, okay, we start from the particulars. And from the particulars, we ascend to a new level of understanding. We develop, we hypothesize, and we come up with a cause or a universal idea, something that is in common. You find in common in all the particulars, okay? Where you're actually looking for what is common to them all, what is generating what you're seeing now. You like what Kepler is doing. He's looking for a principle, something that's universal to the motion of all the planets. So you get to this point where okay, you think you have discovered a new principle. You think you've got a true hypothesis. Now, where Aristotle stops and says this is fine, Socrates says no. Now you have to come back down to the particulars where you started from. And adjust your understanding of the relations between those particulars. Okay? And this is very important for poetry. And so how does poetry mirror this process? So you've got a poet who writes the poem. Obviously. How does he write the poem? Well, he's got an idea in his mind. Okay? That he can't express specifically, like, in words, straight up, okay? I've tried it, it's impossible. People just kind of look at me and they're like, what are you talking about? This doesn't make any sense, this is stupid. This is impossible. Are you calling yourself a poet? So you can't express it in words. Literally. So what do? You say, okay, well I need to communicate this idea because I think it's important. So, I need to figure out a way, using language, obviously, and words, to convey this idea. Okay, well, how does the human mind make a discovery in science? Okay. So I'm going to create, so what metaphors am I going to use? What kind of paradoxes am I going to develop to lead the reader? Because say that the poet is writing, okay, from the standpoint of already having the idea, but he has to write it in a way it is going to draw the reader, in particulars, up to the idea. Okay. It has to be structured in a certain, done in a certain way, that it's not impossible for the reader, but that it's not necessarily, it's not written on the surface either. The reader has to be creative. The reader has to hypothesize and change the way that he or she is thinking over the course of the poem, or you're not going to get it. So there's a certain tension between in a poem that's embedded in it, okay, between the poet who has this top-down approach, okay, who has built it with this single idea, this unifying idea, through the whole poem. And then you've got the reader who has a bottom-up approach, who is reading, okay, has to read the poem and get, work through the metaphors, work through the paradoxes, okay, trying to make sense of these various images or symbols that are being presented to him. And from that, to make a leap. It actually is a creative leap to the understanding of the poem. But the reader can know that the poet will give the necessary tools for the reader to make that discovery. Okay? So like the universe is knowable to the human mind. Okay? It's not like we're down here and truth is up here and knowledge is up here and it's like inseparable. Okay? Same thing in poetry. Except for the modern shit. Because you're not going to get any meaning out of that. The modern shit. Yeah, it'll just depress you. Okay? Because that's the same thing. The is up here, but the poet doesn't have the intention to communicate. Okay?
So I say in modern poetry, the poet has the idea, but can't communicate.
Maybe they have an idea.
Maybe.
You just don't know. You can't really, there's no point even guessing. Maybe they have an idea, maybe they're just, I don't know. Maybe they just shouldn't be writing poetry.
Like
hate or something like that?
Sure,
you could do that. You can promote bad ideas, but you can't promote ideas badly. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Does that make sense to people?
Yeah. You
can promote bad ideas, but you can't promote ideas badly. Because it's not gonna work. Okay? Okay, so we're gonna look at this poem, I think. Do people have any questions before we get started? Because what I'm trying to give you now is I'm not gonna give you any answers to this poem. I'm gonna help you guys. This is not an easy poem. This is one of Shelley's hardest poems, okay, that I've come across. It took me 2 weeks to figure it out, at least. Yeah.
The reason why we'll have to make an effort on this is just to change ourselves and get closer to truth in terms of the...
Well, I think what I'm hoping through reading this is that you're going to get maybe you're going to change the way you think philosophically. What I'm hoping for is that some of you may have profound breakthroughs in terms of your conception of what poetry is. Okay, but that's not going to come from me. It's really a matter of the amount of effort that you're willing to put into something to get something out of it. Because it's like I was talking about Dante, and great literature can change it. The thing about this poem, okay, that I would say is, in terms of how we need to approach this, is it's like what Kempner was doing. Okay, you've got to look for the paradoxes. You've got to look for the words, the images that don't seem to fit with the rest of the poem. Okay, because they're there. The images are there that you need. And I would say that it's about 150 lines, and maybe 50, not even 50 of those lines are crucial for the meaning of the poem. Less than 50. Probably 25.
So, you were saying about the meaning
of the poem, like... Okay. He writes this poem, in Italy, okay, in 1816 roughly. He's traveling through the wilderness, and he's on the edge of the Alps, and he's looking up and he sees this mountain Mont Blanc, okay? I guess it's just towering over all the other mountains in the area. And there's this gorge, okay, which is called the Vale of Chamonix or something like that. Okay. And the river that's going through this gorge is called the Arve. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but it's A-R-V-E.
What's okay. One?
A river.
A river,
okay, which he names in the poem. Okay. He says the ravine of Arve in the first line of the second part. So at first, well, we'll see. We're going to talk. We're going to read a section at a time, and then we are going to discuss. Okay, and we're going to try to develop a sense of what's going on as we go through this. Okay. So I think that that's kind of how we need to approach this poem, like scientists. Okay. I'll read the first part, and then anybody else who wants to try to read a little bit, and practice reading poetry to give you a chance. Okay. Everybody has a copy then before we get started? One other thing I was going to say too is it's not necessary to understand every word in this, okay? Because this is one of the things with this poem is you can get really bogged down with the imagery and the difficult words, but it's not necessary to know all of them. As long as you have an idea of what's going on, okay? And on your own, if you enjoy what we're going to do tonight, you can check it out. You can look up these words. But you were thinking of people that are weaker in English being at the back. Oh yeah, I think that would be great. Yeah, if you guys want to, so we can see each other. The everlasting universe of things flows through the mind and rolls its rapid waves, now dark, now glittering, now reflecting gloom, now lending splendor, where from secret springs the source of human thought its tribute brings of waters. It is sound but half its own.